Which raises another question. That capsule, because we've all seen them in museums now, but they're really awfully small. And the two of you were in there for 14 days together? I mean, how did this affect your relationship?
Well, Borman lost his toothbrush on the third day, so we all used the same toothbrush. Didn't make any difference. And when we finally got down on the carrier deck after 14 days, Frank looked at the crew and said, "I just want to let everybody know that Jim and I are engaged."
Gene, Gemini 9, more rendezvous time, but you're going to be the second man to walk, they call it, do an EVA, extravehicular activity, walk in space.
Second American, third human
second
being.
Second American to do it.
Leona,
so
the
how
Russian
much did
was
we
out
know?
for about 13 minutes and spent three getting out and about 10 trying to get back in. Ed White had a beautiful 20-minute flight. We went up there fat, dumb, and happy, never really thinking too much of Newton's laws of motion for every action, equal opposite reaction, and at zero gravity, it comes out in spades. And I was supposed to fly one of those backpacks on about 120-foot tether around the world. Obviously, not going into a lot of detail, had to basically assemble it outside the spacecraft in a pressure suit that felt like you were in a plaster of Paris suit, and had a lot of trouble. It was one of those rocket packs, Buck Rogers. The only difference is the ones they flew in shuttle had coal gas nitrogen, and mine had hot gas hydrogen peroxide, real rocket engines.
And where was the exhaust for the engine?
Well, there were little quads of rockets, but initially they designed the thing with one of those rockets coming out between your legs. I should have been smart, because I had to wear a special set of woven steel pants over my regular spacesuit so that I wouldn't burn a hole in them. And I, you know, somehow I should have been smarter, but I had a little trouble. And if you think the spacecraft is small when you're in it, you ought to see how small it is when you're out trying to get back in it. That's where I had some problems. But I looked at it. That was my first flight. I came back. I failed my colleagues. It was whatever. And I figured I'd never fly again. But in retrospect, we learned what we didn't know. It was a success like Apollo 13. We learned a lot of things that we didn't know and we could build upon, which led to the success of other spacewalks on Gemini and then eventually into Apollo.
Back up just a little bit to when you first opened the hatch and stood up on the seat and half of you is out there in space and you look around and see it for the first time. Do you recall what the
window in a Gemini is about the size of Jim's glasses? It's about that big. You don't really get to see much. And when I opened a hatch and stood up, first of all, the doctors, we hadn't really had much experience. The doctors said he's going to get spaceship 4, feel like he's falling out of the sky. And I understand you're traveling at 18,000 miles an hour. And I opened that hatch in darkness over the Western Pacific, somewhere between Hawaii and the West Coast, in early morning, and I stood there, and the stars, and all of a sudden I saw the, first of all, sunrises and sunsets in Earth orbit. You don't really see the Earth when you're in Earth orbit. You don't do that till you go to the moon, but the sunrises and sunsets are spectacular. And I'm standing there outside the spacecraft in a zero gravity and in a total vacuum of space, in darkness, and the sun starts gleaming over the horizon, and it comes up pretty fast when you're going 18,000 miles an hour. And all of a sudden, I see the entire coast of California. I could look up to the Oregon coast, down across Baja, and it was a pretty moving moment at that point in time.
Wow.
Had the whole world, the whole universe in front of me, having never been to the moon. This was a pretty spectacular moment.
So that was his flight. You flew the last of the Gemini flights with Buzz Aldrin. What'd you accomplish? You finished up the Gemini program.
That was his contribution to mankind, by the way.
Well, you know, Gene was talking about the problems he had getting into doing EVA or extravehicular activity. The same problems really occurred on Gemini 10 and Gemini 11 because we didn't, as Gene mentioned, remember Newton's third law of motion. To every action, there's an equal and opposite reaction. But we finally came to the conclusion that we better start doing some work to figure out how we could really work out into space. So what we did was we rented a swimming pool in a boys' school in Baltimore, and we sank a mock-up of the back end of the Gemini spacecraft in that pool. Buzz Aldrin was my companion. We put him in a spacesuit, which works just as well underwater as it does in space. We put enough weights around him so that he wouldn't float or sink, but be neutrally buoyant. And we told Buzz, do not swim. And then we figured out various types of handholds and footholds so that he could work out of the spacecraft, around the spacecraft, and not have to fight the zero gravity and the reaction of the spacecraft when he tries to touch it or something like that. It worked out quite well. I think we did about over 5 hours of EVA work, three different types, and so we finally accomplished one of the last things before we went to Apollo.
By the way, David, maybe a little bit more descriptive term. You read it, I know. In my book, I called it, that chapter, Spacewalk from Hell. And the greatest compliment I've ever received was from a friend of mine who said, Gene, I know you made it, but I wasn't sure until I came to the end of the chapter.
Cut to early 1967, January, a static test. Three of your good friend colleagues are sitting on top of the rocket, and there was a fire in the spacecraft. They were lost. How did that affect each of you? How did it affect the whole Apollo program at that point?
Well, I speak for myself, but I kind of think it affected all of us as to the tragedies that can occur in this business. We sometimes think with successes that things go very routinely and you don't really worry about it. And then all of a sudden you have a big tragedy like this. And it was a tragedy that was, you know, if the crew was lost in space or were stranded on the moon or something like that, we can understand that. That was part of our job. But to be sitting on a test in an unfueled rocket when the 16% oxygen of the pressure in there, suddenly there was a fire and killed all three. Well, that was really a tragic to us. And so it took about, 9 months? But NASA recovered. The Apollo Block 1 became the Block 2. We changed the hatch to make it a quick opening hatch. We redid all the electronics in there and the wiring and to make sure that it would be going.
It changed the whole face of the space program, I think. And I remember walking behind a caisson, carrying Roger Chaffee at Arlington. Cold February day, rainy. I mean, it just, and I kept thinking, are we burying our friends? Or are we burying the entire Apollo program? And none of us really knew at that point in time. But, you know, it's an often, too often used phrase, they didn't die in vain. But in fact, these guys gave their lives so that, as Jim said, you know, we all thought, we didn't talk about it, but we thought maybe someday, somewhere down the line, on the way to the moon, we'd lose somebody or someone would get hurt. Because of their sacrifice, we rebuilt the entire spacecraft. We did things we weren't able to do because we didn't have time to do them. We were in a big rush to do them. And I think the result is, think about this. Following the Apollo 7 tragedy, the fire, including Apollo 13, this is a tribute to American ingenuity and commitment and dedication. Everyone who went to the moon came home to talk about it. Think about that. I'm not sure any of us really thought that would be that way.
You mentioned earlier Apollo 8. Apollo 7 was the first, of course, to fly. Wally Schirra and his crew, they went up, they orbited, they made it happen. Yours, Jim, with Frank and Bill Anders, was next with Apollo 8, but they changed your mission. Why?
It's kind of an interesting story, and it shows some of the boldness that the leaders of the space program had in those days. Apollo 8 was really supposed to be an Earth orbital mission using the lunar module, going as high as maybe 4,000 miles for a fast reentry back into the Earth's atmosphere, as would be for coming back from the moon. But two things happened in the summer of 1968 that changed the mission completely. The first thing was that we had intelligence information that the Russians were going to put a man or men around the moon, not orbit, but just circumnavigate the moon, go back to the Earth in the late fall of 1968. And it turned out here in later years, when the secrecy was opened up and we got to know more about the program, they were actually very serious about that. In the summer of 68, they sent a spacecraft called Zond 5 with animals on board, and it circumnavigated the moon, came back and landed in the Pacific, but its reentry was too steep and all the animals had died. But the Russians were very, concerned people and very determined to do something. They sent Zond 6 a little while later, and that flight was somewhat successful. But then in Russia, there was a big argument as to should we send more animals or should we send men. Leonov wanted to go, but they argued back and forth. Meantime, in this country, when we found out that the lunar module was never going to be ready for a 1968 flight, our leadership said, well, listen, if Apollo 7 is correct or successful on its 11-day Earth orbital flight, then let's just send the command service module without a lunar module to the moon, check out the navigation, check out the communication, have them orbit, look for suitable landing spots so that we give the guys the greatest chance of survival, and hopefully we can bring it back. And so Apollo 8 was really the high point of my career. First people to see the far side of the moon, first people to navigate all the way to the moon, and to see the Earth as it really is, which is really the most impressive sight that I've seen, to see how small it is and the fact that we are to be here on Earth and to live here.
Most of you are a generation removed from what Jim is talking about, but he was on the crew, one of the first three human beings ever to leave this planet and circle another planet. The first picture of Earthrise over the moon's horizon was brought back by Jim and his colleagues. And the thing you don't remember, which is written in history but not published often enough, it was on Christmas Eve they went. And all of us on the ground were waiting as they went around the moon for the last time. They had to fire their engine to leave the moon's environment and head back to the Earth to get captured by the Earth gravity. And that was a very tense moment for everybody. And when they came around the moon, the first words that we heard were from Jim Lovell on Christmas Eve.
And he said,
Houston, be informed there really is a Santa Claus.
And also, you and Bill and Frank all read passages from Genesis. Whose idea was that?
Well, when we found out, and this was strictly a coincidence, that we were going to burn into lunar orbit on Christmas Eve, we said, oh my gosh, what a time to say something. What can we say? So we thought we'd change the verses to the night before Christmas. That didn't sound too good. And how about a new verse to Jingle Bells? Well, that was even worse. And then we asked a friend of, actually Frank had a friend who was in the
USAID?
He had a friend who was a newspaper man. And so he asked this newspaper man, since they write stories all the time, what can this crew say around the moon on New Year's Eve? So he started to think one night, what can we say? And he was writing things and writing things. It got to be about 1 o'clock in the morning when his wife came down and said, what are you doing? And he says, I have this assignment to figure out what this crew can say around the moon on New Year's Eve. And she says, well, that's simple. Why don't you have them read from the first 10 verses of Genesis from the Old Testament, because that is the basis of most of the world's religions, not just the Christian religion, but others too. And so that's how it came to pass. On the last orbit around the moon, we read the first 10 verses of Genesis.
Gene jumped to 10. 9, of course, was McDivitt's. They were successful, but now it's your Apollo mission.
Came Apollo 10, because he went to Lunar Mars, or went to the moon without a moon. He kept Apollo 10 from being the first attempt to land. But anyway, we were the second lunar module to fly. First one on 9 around in the Earth. It was perfect. And so the decision was made to take the lunar module to the moon and test it and check it out, do everything there was to do except land. And so we did. We literally painted the white line in the sky so Neil Armstrong would not get lost, and that was our we went and duplicated their mission, went down to 47,000 feet right above their landing site, and instead of going all the way down, we turned around and came back.